This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
This summer's almost certain standoff will either end in real give-and-take negotiations or terrible escalation.
The voice of the late legendary Walter Cronkite talking about Vietnam. Military experts are saying similar things today about the state of the U.S. fight in Afghanistan. We'll explore that battle for Afghanistan and Cronkite's legacy today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, which means that we are bringing you The Takeaway agenda. But it is Monday, July 20th. I am Farai Chidea here with Todd Zwillick. We are filling in for the famous and infamous John Hockenberry. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Farai.
So, again, the agenda, crowdsourcing your job search, too old to be a mom, all these different things. Plus, we're bringing you the latest developments in Afghanistan this weekend. The Taliban released a video of a scared U.S. soldier. Government is calling it propaganda. In a few minutes, we'll have more. But let's go to Nicholas Schmidl, author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nick, this 23-year-old soldier was captured late last month. So why now is the Taliban releasing the video? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, I think that the Taliban are, in many ways, trying to show that even though the U.S. has grabbed the momentum, perhaps, in southern Afghanistan and Helmand, that the epicenter of al-Qaeda and the Taliban's activities in eastern Afghanistan is still firmly in control of the militants. And I think that this video really, really illustrates that and really drives that point home.
Oh, okay. Nick Schmidl, we're going to talk to you more about the situation later in the show. Hostage situation, 23-year-old. We're going to talk about the Afghan battlefield as well. First, everything you need to know this morning. President Obama is marking 40 years since humans walked on the moon. The Apollo 11 crew visits the White House. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Frank McCourt is dead at 78. He wrote the best-selling memoir Angela's Ashes. The president also focusing on health care.
Farai, top lender CIT has a new deal for a massive loan to avoid bankruptcy. Our partner, the New York Times, reports this morning the company's board approved a $3 billion emergency loan. The New York Times also reports this morning the U.S. military plans to overhaul the controversial jail at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. This follows detainee abuse allegations there.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in India today, part of a trip to Asia. She is talking terror and nuclear policy.
We're talking about the historic moon landing today, 40 years ago. Well, meanwhile, Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts are in the heavens now. NASA's current concern is not quite as exciting as a lunar stroll or a shot to Mars. Today, the astronauts are busy fixing a toilet that leaked on the International Space Station.
Well, I want to go to the markets. Asian markets closed up this morning, leading indices gained around 3%. On Wall Street, the Dow starts trading at 87.43, S&P 940, NASDAQ 1886. And of course, we lost this great American voice, Walter Cronkite. We want to know, who is the newscaster that you trust? Who is the Walter Cronkite of today? Or do you simply think it's not replicable? Spence emails us, there is no Walter Cronkite, nor should there be. The best way to know what is happening is to read good newspapers and listen to NPR and the BBC. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Todd Zwillick. We are in for John Hockenberry. There is some chilling video released this weekend of the first American soldier to be captured by the Taliban since the war started in Afghanistan.
Well, I am scared. I'm scared I won't be able to go home. It is very unnerving to be a prisoner.
That's 23-year-old Private Bo Bergdahl, who was serving with an infantry regiment in eastern Afghanistan. Reportedly, the soldier was last seen walking away from his base near the Pakistan border in an area known to be a Taliban stronghold. Nicholas Schmidl has reported from Pakistan. In fact, he's the author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation. Nick, how are you?
Thanks for having me on, Farah. I'm doing well, thanks.
So what do we know about who's holding Private Bergdahl and what's being done to secure his release?
Well, we unfortunately don't know much. The reports are suggesting that he was grabbed by local Taliban and then sort of sold up the chain to potentially the Haqqani Network, the group that is based in Khost, Afghanistan, and in North Waziristan of Pakistan. The only individual who has said something publicly about his capture is a guy named Mullah Sangin, who was an associate of the Haqqani Network. And within 48 hours of his disappearance, this guy had said that, you know, that the soldier would be killed if there was any raids or anything that came on to them.
Now, we're seeing militarily some new tactics by the Taliban, increased use of IEDs in Afghanistan. Are those tactics ones that are coming from Iraq?
It's hard to say exactly where they're coming from. We're certainly seeing more of them. Now, it's hard to know whether there are just more bomb makers and more jihadis coming from Iraq or whether there are smarter jihadis and bomb makers coming from Iraq that are bringing technology with them. And I don't know that we can answer that question now. I do think, though, that much of the technology and the know-how can simply be transferred over the internet. And I think that the Taliban's internet, I mean, the Al-Qaeda's internet setup is quite sophisticated at this point. So the technology could simply be moving over the internet.
I want to talk a little bit about the non-explosive, non-battle, non-gun strategy that is the communications war. Nick, let's listen to another clip of Private Bergdahl.
To my fellow Americans who have loved ones over here, who know what it's like to miss them, you have the power to make our government bring them home. Please, please bring us home so that we can be back where we belong and not over here wasting our time and our lives and our precious life that we could be using back in our own country. Please bring us home.
Nick, that is plaintive, to say the least. And, no one can imagine being in that situation, but it is of an emotional tone where it will no doubt get to, get under the skin of ordinary Americans as well as make the military, the urgency of this clear. When you have this kind of a video of a man who's been captured for weeks, what does it do in that communications war between the Taliban and the United States?
Well, I'm really glad you played that clip because I think that that is perhaps the most befuddling clip so far that we've seen from any of the captures and the kidnappings of late in the border areas. In that the demands are obviously demands that are not going to be met, and yet they are very concrete. And I think that in the past, we've heard demands that have been, we need to get Israel out of Palestine, by the end of the week or something like that. And so these are concrete demands that should the Taliban have concrete goals and objectives in Afghanistan, which are hard to conflate, which, we actually obviously have to be careful not to conflate with those of Al-Qaeda. And I think that it's an interesting sort of, like you said, it's an interesting shot in the propaganda war. I'm not exactly sure what it means. I'm not exactly sure where what it means in terms of the Taliban's priorities over those of Al-Qaeda in this area and sort of who's calling the shots between them.
Nick, the Taliban's priorities, this is Todd Zwillick here, but what about American commanders in a situation like this, not only pursuing their own strategy, but as Farai said, pursuing the propaganda war against the Taliban? They're holding one of our own. They're producing videos. You're a colonel. You're a general in Afghanistan. What does this do to their strategy and how do they approach this? Now they walk a finer line.
Well, yeah, you're right. The other thing it does is it inherently makes you a little bit more emotional, and I think that that's what the Taliban want because I think that that's how people make mistakes. And if you're an American colonel right now in Afghanistan, excuse me, you are thinking right now, how do we get the soldier out? And you're thinking about sort of nighttime Delta Force raids and things like that that are inherently going to also take some risk. And so I think that it's the thing about this video is that it's such a there's nothing that you can really counter it with at this point. And so I think that right now they feel somewhat like their hands are tied.
Well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan. Now we have someone who is in the region. Wall Street Journal reporter Anand Gopal joins us from Kabul, Afghanistan. We want to know what the military situation is on the ground. It's been a bloody month. What is going on militarily?
Well, this has been a bloody month. It's actually, we've reached record numbers in terms of soldiers killed. We're averaging about 3 a day. At the same time, there's an offensive going on in the south, which is the largest coordinated U.S. offensive in the whole war. It's about 4,000 Marines that are going and trying to root out the Taliban from various strongholds. Because of these sorts of offenses and because insurgencies have a larger presence this year, we're seeing much higher casualty rate.
You have also been writing about eastern Afghanistan, where villagers have begun attacking the Taliban. What's happening there? What made them change their position?
This is a particular district in the Indian-Pakistan border, which has been targeted by the Taliban for a number of years. And over the last few months, a few government officials have come to the village and promised them jobs and development if they would break their ties with the militants. And so there was an incident over the weekend in which Taliban fighters tried to kidnap a police officer. This led to clashes, and the villagers actually came and captured the Taliban fighters and handed them over to the police, which is sort of an unprecedented move. Now, this is still just an isolated thing, but officials hope that they could sort of replicate this throughout the region.
And on this attempt to triangulate villagers against the Taliban really sounds like the strategy that was used in the Sunni Awakening in Iraq, getting some of the tribal elders and people on our side, sometimes with cash, sometimes with political power. Am I drawing an accurate parallel between these two things?
Yes, it is accurate. It's a little more complicated here in Afghanistan because in Iraq they were able to get Sunni tribesmen to fight against outsiders or perceived outsiders, which was al-Qaeda. Here in Afghanistan, in the villages, the Taliban are the brothers and the sons of the various people that Western officials are trying to target. So it's much more difficult to separate these elements out.
When you take a look at the video of Private Bergdahl, do you think that the U.S. will pursue a military option for release or some kind of negotiation? Is it even possible for the U.S. to negotiate with the Taliban?
It's very unlikely that they'll try to negotiate. And what we've seen in the past, there have been other Westerners that have been abducted, for example, NGO workers. And the U.S. military has been involved in trying to free them using special forces. In the region in which this soldier was taken, the U.S. has blanketed the area with leaflets, some promising rewards for any information leading to his retrieval, and others threatening villagers who may have information and withhold it.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Really important information from Kabul, Afghanistan, Wall Street Journal reporter Anand Gopal. I want to go back to Nicholas Schmidl at the New America Foundation. Negotiation, just very quickly, the issue of negotiating with the Taliban. Anand said, no way, not going to happen. What do you think?
Well, I think that it's happening at one level. I don't know that it's happening with these particular commanders who are holding the soldier, but I do think that U.S. military strategy right now is about trying to find irreconcilables and to try and convince them to sort of, you know, turn sides, if you will, like you mentioned, in the Anbar Awakening.
Is this a pivotal moment for the U.S. in Afghanistan?
I think that remains to be seen whether this is any more of a pivotal moment in Afghanistan than, say, the 4,000 soldiers who landed in Helmand a few weeks ago has been. I think that, it remains to be seen how this all plays out, whether the special forces go in, whether negotiations do take place that we don't know about.
All right. Thanks again, Nicholas Schmidl, fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan.
Thanks for having me on.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, and today marks the 40th anniversary of Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon.
The surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. And a step off the land mount. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Now, this has got us wondering, who are the space travelers of the future? We thought we'd check in with a couple of them. Kate Rubins was just selected to join the 2009 astronaut candidate class in Houston, Texas, the next generation of astronauts. She is in Houston. And we've also got Tina Druskin. She's a high school sophomore who just got back from space camp in Huntsville, Alabama.
So
welcome
lucky.
I know.
Space camp. Gosh, doing what I want to do.
Now, let me start with you, Kate. You were selected as one of just 9 people in the 2009 astronaut class. So who is NASA looking for today, and what is it that you do?
Well, I think they're looking for a wide variety of experience. I don't think there's a particular type. Certainly they're looking for pilots, scientists, and engineers. But for me, for example, I'm a biomedical researcher coming into space exploration and space science.
And you know, Tina, you are hoping to be Kate and then hoping to go into space, I assume. What was, first of all, let's just be honest, what was the best moment of space camp, Tina?
I think it was doing the different simulators and, like, having fun doing that, but meeting all the new people, too.
So when you think about what lies ahead for you in your career as you get older, what would you like to do?
Well, I'd really like to be an astronaut and go into space, but I don't have, like, one specific goal.
All right, Kate, advice. What would you tell Tina that she should do in order to prepare to try to be an astronaut?
Well, I think the important thing is, you know, obviously a lot of science and engineering and math, and that's pretty critical, but there's some other skills that are important, too. So, for example, foreign languages is starting to become increasingly important as we're working with our international collaborators on the space station. For me, it was really finding something that I was passionate about. You know, I've been a molecular biologist for the last 10 years, and finding something that you love and that you can really delve into and explore seems to be one of the very common themes among all of my fellow astronaut candidates.
Hey, Tina, Todd Zwillick here. I have to ask, simulators, what did you get to do? Did you get to do the weightless simulator? Did you go in a pool? Can you tell me what you got to do, please? I'm jealous.
Well, we did the 1/6 simulator, which is supposed to simulate what it'd be like to walk on the moon.
Right, 1/6 gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we did the G-force simulator.
Centrifuge.
Yes.
Awesome.
And then we did, like, simulators where you were flying, like, the shuttle and other planes.
That's great.
Uh-oh, Todd. Next time, Todd is going to try to take your slot. I mean, I have to go back to you, Kate. Your dream was to go into space, and you decided to, you know, do something more practical as an infectious disease specialist. Now you have the shot to do this. Is the space program healthy enough for you to achieve your dream?
I think so. I think actually this is a really exciting time to be part of the space program. You know, a lot of things are up in the air, and with the end of the shuttle and the start of Constellation, it's one of those periods where things are in flux, and we're getting into a really exciting time in terms of the kinds of technologies that are being developed. So I'm thrilled to be getting in at the ground floor of Constellation and to be part of some of the exploration that's coming up. I think it's a great time.
All right, that's Kate Rubins, accepted to the 2009 astronaut candidate class, and Tina Druskin's 15-year-old high school sophomore who just got back from space camp. There's also been a lot of talk about the historic moments of the U.S. space program.
Armstrong is on the moon. Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
The voice, of course, of Walter Cronkite there announcing the landing on the moon 40 years ago today, July 20th. The host of CBS Evening News, Walter Cronkite, was called the fourth astronaut for the incredible amount of hours he spent covering the space program and NASA, and they were very grateful to him for it, I can tell you that. On Friday night, broadcast legend Walter Cronkite died at the age of 92 after a long bout with cerebrovascular disease. Joining us now in remembering the television news legend and an example to us all in the news business and in broadcasting, Cronkite's former executive producer for CBS Evening News, Sanford Sokolo. Sanford, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Sanford, you listen to all of these clips. I know you've heard them all weekend long. You've heard them since Friday, the moonshot, Vietnam. I just want you to share what you're thinking about as we all come back to you now for homage and remembrance of a mentor to us all.
Well, certainly we miss him, and we miss his attitude, I think, in a lot of current media practices. And he himself was kind of disappointed in the way the media goes. But you also have to remember that he practiced in a universe in which there was much less competition than there is today. The technology has gotten so dramatic, I don't think even he understood what was going on. The technology has just raced ahead of us. He was dominant in a universe in which there were just two media giants, NBC News and CBS News. ABC News still hadn't matured. And it was that in that universe that he became so dominant. His ratings on the day he stepped down in 1981 were bigger than all three network news shows put together today.
All right. Well, Sanford, let's go to a clip of your friend and colleague Walter Cronkite and take the conversation from there.
It seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. This summer's almost certain standoff will either end in real give-and-take negotiations or terrible escalation. And for every means we have to escalate, the enemy can match us. And that applies to invasion of the North, the use of nuclear weapons, or the mere commitment of 100 or 200 or 300,000 more American troops to the battle. And with each escalation, the world comes closer to the brink of cosmic disaster.
Sanford, we don't have a lot of time left. Unfortunately, it's brief. But that was Vietnam, of course. Are Americans as in touch with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan now as they were in Cronkite's time? What are we missing in terms of the reporting that Cronkite brought to the table?
Well, we're missing one dominant voice that can tell us really what's going on and lead us. I mean, there are so many voices, and it's so disparate that there isn't any sort of dominant intelligence out there in the media world. Cronkite was dismayed at what he saw in Vietnam in 1968 and came back and shared it with the American people. That sort of thing can't happen in the current media world.
24-hour news cycle. Sanford Sokolo, former executive producer at CBS for 32 years, longtime colleague and friend of Walter Cronkite. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with Farai Chidea. We're both here for John Hockenberry, who's away. And now it's time for headlines, and here's Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. Till 28 minutes to the top of the hour. The Pentagon is calling for an overhaul of the American-run prison at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. It also wants to make changes to the entire Afghan prison and judicial system. Now, that's according to our partner, The New York Times. In Mumbai, the sole surviving gunman of the November terrorist attacks has pleaded guilty. He confessed today in an Indian court. Here in the US, the lender CIT has received a $3 billion loan from some of its major bondholders, and that's according to our partner, The New York Times. And that deal gives the bank some time to restructure its business model and avert bankruptcy. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Delhi today, where she's praising India's neighbour Pakistan for taking on extremists. She's calling for more help from India in the fight against terrorism. Now, there are plenty of high-profile events to mark the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 Eagle module landing on the moon. But our favourite in the newsroom is Buzz Aldrin's new hip-hop number.
Uh-oh.
Yes, I did say it. Hip-hop.
Uh-oh.
Rocket Experience.
Let's take a trip to Mars. Our destiny is to the stars.
So Aldrin wants to get more people interested in space, and he's doing it by using his rocket experience.
Got me hooked.
Search it. It's worth it.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bailout.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on?
It is Monday, and that means it's time for our agenda segment, a look at the week ahead. We're here with Marcus Mabry, always our friend, and also the international business editor for a partner, The New York Times. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning.
And also we've got Jill McGivering from London. She's the BBC correspondent specializing in Asia. Hello.
Good morning.
So let's start with healthcare. President Obama's plan faces a crucial moment. The House Democratic leaders are moving towards a face-off with party moderates, and a Senate committee is working on a bipartisan alternative. Marcus, tell us about this Senate committee and what exactly is going on.
Well, you know, the Senate Finance Committee is working on a bipartisan proposal for healthcare reform. It is the only bipartisan plan out there, or they hope it will be out there. What's interesting about this plan is, given how we have seen in on the House side, the two House committees, two of the three that have to deal with this have already dealt with the reform bill. And what we saw in those committees were we actually saw Democrats crossing party lines to side with Republicans. Now, it'll be interesting. In the Senate, we saw in the Senate committee dealt with it so far, we saw a straight party line vote. What's interesting about this bipartisan effort in the Senate Finance Committee is if they can come up with a bill is going to get actually Republican support, you'll have some sense of what a bipartisan compromise might look like. The president has been extraordinary and is kind of like, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. The Republicans come with us or without us.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about how the president is handling the fight. Here's a bit of his weekly address.
The same folks who controlled the White House and Congress for the past 8 years as we ran up record deficits will argue, believe it or not, that health reform will lead to record deficits. That's simply not true.
All right. The Clinton administration is a legendary cautionary tale in how health care may hurt a presidency in terms of an agenda. What do you hear when you listen to Obama, and is he in any peril of sort of facing the health care curse?
What's been extraordinary is the sense, you know, he is famous for being very laid back, very zen about these things. We have not seen him so kind of bold in any other agenda item. If you compare the healthcare reform debate over, say, the reform of the financial industry in the wake of the crisis debate, he has been much more confident, much more assertive, almost staking his presidency on the fact that we'll actually have proposals on both floors of both houses by the end of summer. That's extraordinary.
Marcus, I want to go to Jill. Jill, you are the BBC Asia editor, and Hillary Clinton is going to be in the Indian capital, Delhi, for talks on Monday as part of a week-long Asia trip. She's there to bolster political and economic ties. Here's a little bit about what she had to say.
United States does not and will not do anything that would limit India's economic progress.
Decode that a little bit for us. What is she talking about, and what kinds of relationship building is she trying to do?
I think it's been interesting that most of what the rhetoric we've heard from has been very positive, and a lot of the briefing from the State Department has been, you know, look, we have a great relationship with India, we want to strengthen it, we want to improve it, we want to deepen it. And some of the rhetoric she's been getting in return from the Indian officials hasn't sound quite so matey. It's as though she's really on a charm offensive but is finding some difficult issues. And I think one of those issues was what she was referring to there, which is this whole business about climate change. We know that the Obama administration is trying to do what it can now to look at US involvement in the next big international treaty on limiting carbon emissions and so on. And we understand part of Mrs. Clinton's message in India has been, you know, you guys are known to have very large amounts of carbon emission. You're growing very quickly. Can we persuade you also to accept some sort of caps on carbon emissions to get you to sign up to something in the future? But so far, India's been saying, no, thank you. You know, we have seen all you guys develop. We are now just starting to develop, and we don't want anything that's going to limit or affect our economic growth. And their argument is, look, per capita, we've got over 1 billion people. So if you look at it per capita and not just as an overall amount, we're not doing so badly.
And Jill, Hillary Clinton actually faced a pretty explicit statement from, I think, the Indian Minister of the Environment. Is that correct? Who came out and said in no uncertain terms, the answer is no, and said it verbally, which is sort of rare in diplomatic circles.
Well, that's right. I think it gives you a sense of how strongly a lot of people in India feel about this. I mean, I lived in India for a few years for the BBC, and there was very often this really angry sense of, how dare you guys try and tell us what to do, especially on issues when you're being hypocritical and you're not doing it yourselves. So I think there's quite a strong sense there of, you know, by all means, you go and set your house in order and get your thing sorted out and live up to your obligations, but leave us alone. We are just starting to develop. We have a lot of problems. We have a lot of economic problems now. We're trying to deal with poverty, but also trying to expand our export markets, and we don't need anything that might hinder us in doing that. So it's a really tough issue, I think, she's trying to deal with there.
Right. Jill, I'm going to go back to Marcus Mabry of the New York Times. There were huge profits by big banks last week. But what about smaller banks? You know, there's this report that is expected, earnings reports from smaller regional banks. What do you see ahead?
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to see over this week and next week, we're going to have thousands of smaller banks, regional banks, reporting their second quarter's earning results. And what we're going to see, contrasting to what the big guys did on Wall Street and how well the big guys did on Wall Street. We're talking about Goldman Sachs, of course, J.P. Morgan. We'll have Morgan Stanley this week as well as these regional banks. Their results will not be nearly as solicitous. They will actually give us some indication of as much as some estimate $30 billion in commercial loans that are going bad, the highest number in nearly 20 years. The banking crisis is not over, and we're going to see it in these earnings reports this week and next.
I want to thank Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times, and Jill McGivering, BBC correspondent from London, who specializes in Asia.
All right, Fry, well, what do you do if you're out of work and out of hope? Well, what you do is you get a friend to help you out. More about how a helpful job search buddy can be, and that's coming up in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Michael Vick, the fallen NFL star convicted of running a dog-fighting ring, has just been this morning released from 2 months of house arrest, which followed an 18-month stint behind federal prison bars. So does this release mean that he's headed back to the NFL, or will he be shut out, or should he be? To talk about what's in store for this fallen football star, our friend and Takeaway sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, joins us. Good morning, Ibrahim. How are you?
I'm good, and yourself?
I'm well, thank you. Michael Vick is off house arrest. So what's at stake for the NFL? How do they handle this?
Well, first of all, think of one person who's done more for animal rights than Michael Vick.
Right.
He shed the light.
Unwittingly.
He shed the light on dog fighting and cockfighting and any kind of animal fighting more than anyone could have done in many, many, many years.
Speaking of animal rights, I just want to recall this because I love this piece of sound so much from back when Michael Vick was first arrested and accused. Senator Robert Byrd, dog lover, senator from West Virginia.
Barbaric. Let that word resound from hill to hill and from mountain to mountain, from valley to valley. Across this broad land, barbaric, barbaric.
They don't make speeches like that anymore in the Senate. But it does make me ask, Ibrahim, you know, being called barbaric all across the country and not just by senators, can the NFL afford to put this guy back in the game?
That's an interesting question. We're in an age where media, this hyper-obsessive media that follows athletes everywhere they go, maybe 20 years ago you wouldn't even have known about it, but they might have had bigger dog rings. They might have had bigger fighting rings. Vic is a victim of that in a sense, but he's also a victim of his own bad decision-making. So at this point, he's paid his debt to society, so to speak. And at the end of the day, it was – basically, people are not going to be doing it as much as they were before. There's never going to be dogfighting to the level that it was before this. I think Michael Vick right now is ready to play in the NFL.
You think he is? You think the NFL is ready for Michael Vick?
I don't think they're ready for him. But I think that Goodell has to make a decision. Are you gonna show second chances? Are you gonna show that there's an opportunity that if you go through the process, you do everything that you're supposed to do, that they'll welcome you back? And he can help somebody. At the end of the day, he can help somebody.
All right. Well, we're talking about sports. Let's switch gears real quickly because we don't want to leave out Tom Watson, who made quite a run over the weekend. 59 years old, right? How much do we read into this? Golf is the only sport that's on television where a 59-year-old man can almost win a major. Is golf the new, you know, the new sport of the nearly Medicare patient? What's happening?
It's definitely. We were talking about it earlier. We had Lance Armstrong, who's poised to win his eighth Tour de France. You have Tom Watson coming to a shot within almost – it was in his hands. He could have won, right. But he just didn't do it. Stuart Sink came through. But we're not going to remember this as the British Open where Stuart Sink won. We're going to remember it as the one that Tom Watson lost. I think golf is the only sport – I think Ture had a little tweet about it. It's the only sport where literally a guy who's 59 years old can compete. However, Satchel Paige – pitched as a rookie in Major League Baseball when he was 46 years old.
Oh, he did.
Exactly. So I think that – and he was still pitching when he was in his late 50s. So I think the longevity of athletes is based on the era. And in this era, the longevity of golf and cycling is longer than any other sport.
Thanks to nutrition, thanks to Lord knows what. But he's got a great swing for a 59-year-old. It's quite amazing how hard he hits the ball straight.
It was also a shorter course.
All right, let's not take anything away from him. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor, talking about Tom Watson and Michael Vick. Thanks for joining us.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with Farai Chidea. So Farai, looking for a job can be hard, of course, but looking for a job with a friend to help you out can make it a whole lot easier. We're going to learn more about that right after these headlines with Ms. Femi Okeh, who's here now.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, expect talk of the red planet at the White House today. The Apollo 11 crew meets with President Obama this afternoon to mark 40 years since their lunar landing. They're expected to make the case for a mission to Mars. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Frank McCourt is dead at 78. He died in New York. He reached millions through his acclaimed memoir, Angela's Ashes, about his poor childhood in Ireland. Here's McCourt on our member station, WNYC, in late 2007.
What has happened to me and the things I've accomplished could never have happened in Ireland. Ireland shaped me in a sense, but I used to go back with a chip on my shoulder. I don't anymore. I think I've sung my song and made my point.
McCourt also wrote about his life as an English teacher in New York City public schools. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in India today. She's having wide-ranging talks with the leadership there. Terrorism, trade, energy and education are among her top topics. And in Iran, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is pushing back hard on new criticism of the presidential election. He's now warning them to back down and not threaten order in the Islamic State. And this comes after a former president, the reform-minded Mohammad Khatami, called for a referendum as to whether the winning presidential candidate's government is legitimate. The Pentagon calls a Taliban video of a captured American soldier illegal propaganda. It shows Private Bo Bagdal, who had been missing from his eastern Afghanistan base for 3 weeks. He speaks about his fears of captors prod him to talk. And NATO reports that a British fighter jet is down in southern Afghanistan. That's the second big crash in 2 days. The crew ejected before it went down, and the cause is now under investigation, but it doesn't appear that militants shot it down. That's a look at some of the top headlines from this morning's news.
All right, thank you, Femi. Well, it's Monday when we explore issues around work, and if you've ever found yourself out of work, you probably know that motivation can be the hardest part of that job hunt. Well, what do you do when your get up and go gets up and leaves you? How about getting an advisor or a team of advisors, a bunch of friends, to keep you motivated and to keep you honest about your job hunt? And the best part is, that doesn't cost a darn thing, not a dime. Well, we're here in the studio with Deborah DiRago. She's a New Yorker who is looking for a job search buddy. Debbie, a job search buddy, you've got a team of people that you want to help you look for a job. What exactly are you doing? What are you looking for here?
I'm actually looking for it could be a group, but you work in pairs. This is the idea behind it. Someone to do a few different things. One is help you network. Two is keep you on track and goals and help you keep moving forward in your shirts.
This
That's
is like
important.
They used to talk about life coaches, somebody who calls you up once
right.
a week and says, have you done these things?
But yeah, but you're not paying the person.
Right.
That's important.
What would you pay them with?
And also just for emotional support, because they're going through the exact same thing you're going through. There's a lot of ups and downs, which people don't understand unless they're in the same situation as you are. So it works on a few different levels, I think.
This is a reciprocal relationship.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. you're there for each other.
Mm-hmm. You help them network. They help you network. What about is there a peer pressure aspect to this? Getting things done and somebody's looking over your shoulder?
I noticed that.
You do?
I noticed it a little. Well, I think that, we make a list of 5 things to do each week, and then we report in the next week. Well, what did you do? How are you going with this? And I think some people feel like if they haven't done it, it's not like that. It's just to help you keep moving forward. So you kind of have to have a good attitude about it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'm thinking is, traditionally you can stay in your own field and look, but I think now you need to have a plan B or maybe even a C. So I'm also looking for people who are thinking of having their own business ideas and all kinds of stuff like that too. So I think it's just open, but the most important thing is staying on track and keep moving forward.
And that's easier to do maybe when you have a bunch of people doing it all together.
Absolutely,
than just one person.
Or at least one person.
All right. Well, Marcy Alba has been writing about this very thing on her blog called Working the New Economy. It's on Yahoo. She's been writing about job buddy dynamics. Is this something that's widespread, Marcy? Are you seeing this in a lot of places?
I'm seeing it all over the place, and I have some firsthand experience for it because when I became a journalist, I had been a lawyer before. I used a group like this to make a career change, exactly like what Debbie's talking about with the plan B. And I had this group of 2 wannabe journalists at the time. We met in a writing class. We met once a week to kind of keep each other accountable, to kind of share networking resources, to kind of just stay on top of each other and make sure we all did the things we said we were going to do.
Okay, so how would the dynamic work? Instead of we're here in a radio studio, there's 4 of us sitting around a table. So we would be in a Starbucks or some other
or somebody's home.
Somebody's home, some kind of coffee shop. Say, gee, Farai, you were supposed to mail out 2 letters the other day to 2 prospective employers, and I just need to know, have you done that? Have you called that editor that you were supposed to call?
Yeah,
and
I was too afraid. I was too afraid to call the editor. I thought that he or she might not take my phone call.
Okay, and then
let's do a little role play. Why don't we practice that? See how it might sound. The other thing we always did is like meet in a place where you got the laptops, and you could accomplish something sometimes during the meeting. So if you needed to research something, one of the reasons people don't follow through on something is sometimes they never did that first step. Well, maybe you do it while you're sitting there with the other people watching you, helping you, kind of giving you that little confidence boost you need.
Debbie, you're nodding.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the type of dynamic that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Here's my question. Mm-hmm. Do you need a job search buddy to find your job search buddies?
Well, you actually do because some people won't continue with it. So I am actually talking to someone later today who seems really interested and motivated. Because some people are just going to fall away because they're not going to have the motivation and the drive to keep going.
And having a couple is also handy if somebody finds a job. Because, yes, the plan A and B is still something I think you should have these ongoing groups in your career, not just when you're looking for a job, but kind of the career support group that we should all be worried about what's next.
Well, Marcy, it strikes me that this could be a class-based or education-based phenomenon, because it's one of the things that we have to look at is the different categories of people who are searching for jobs. There are some people, for example, who may have had the same job for 25 years doing something that's not being done anymore, like making parts for a car that's no longer in production. What do you do if not only have you been downsized, but your entire field has been essentially eliminated?
Yeah, I think that's the challenge, and that's happening in you say class-based, and you're referring to kind of the manual laborer whose job doesn't exist anymore. It's happening to a lot of journalists who are finding, you know, it happens in all kinds of fields right now. It's happened to the whole mortgage industry, right, who have to figure out what to do now. And that really is like the classic career search. You got to figure out what are your skills and who uses the same skills. And a buddy could totally help you figure that. You do a brainstorm. This is what I'm good at. You know, I'm good at certain things, and you name them. And then you get together and say, well, what are other fields that use exactly those same skills? And how could we figure out how those fields work? And together you go through that project, try to meet people in that field, try to find out where, if anywhere, the jobs are. Did the stimulus package do any help in that sector? All kinds of questions.
All right. How can this go wrong? I have to ask, because you're facing up to peers who are trying to hold you accountable. There's got to be some tension that's possible.
Well, I think two things I'd watch out for, and one Debbie's already experienced is, if you're being like fixed up with strangers, or you're you know, it's like dating. I mean, you could find that somebody's just wrong for you, that you're a bad match, and this person who is supposed to kind of be a cheerleader with you is actually undermining you in some way. So,
you've experienced that, Demi, already?
Yeah, or they just sometimes it could be a little negative. It's hard to stay positive all the time, but you know, I'm not looking to be around negative people. I'm looking for people who are positive and want to move forward.
What do you want out of a job? What's your ideal dream job?
Actually, I'd like to be an entrepreneur, work for, and start my own company. That's something I'm thinking about.
In what field?
I have a background in international event planning with pharmaceutical companies, and which never got hit by the economy before, but now, of course, have gone. So I would like to continue to do that. Also, I have an organizing, freelance organizing, professional organizing company. So I'm looking into a variety of things.
All right, there you have it. Debbie DeRago's getting ready, needs some freelance organizing, international pharmaceutical event planning. You heard it here first. This is a little impromptu career planning session, but she needs a little help. Also, Marcy Alba, her career expert. She writes the blog Working the New Economy on Yahoo. She's been writing about job search buddy groups, the latest trend in the unemployment crisis.
And we are remembering an American news legend, Walter Cronkite. John Hockenberry wrote a piece about Cronkite called Walter Was My Space Buddy. He was a huge fan of the space program. You can read it on thetakeaway.org. We're also asking, who's taking the torch? Who is your Walter Cronkite?
Jeffrey from Manhattan. In my opinion, Bill Moyers is the lone voice of truth and courage to speak it in the media, bar none.
We also have Brooklyn Chick, who wrote on our site, Scott Simon, hands down, and Neil emailed, today the person who has the credibility of Walter Cronkite is Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! It can only be someone on public radio or TV because no commercial network is interested or capable of maintaining a reporter independent of all commercial interest. Give us your take, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James O. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The president is throwing down the gauntlet.
I realize that the last few miles of any race are the hardest to run. But I have to say, now is not the time to slow down.
The multi-trillion dollar debate over health care roils in the Congress as the president sits on the sidelines. But no more. Some of the president's allies have turned tail and fled. Even lawmakers in his own party are rebelling. It's time for Barack Obama to join the fight.
Get your back off the wall, get your back off the wall, get your back off the wall, get your back off
the president is finally stepping through the ropes in the healthcare fight. That's round one. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, July 20th. I'm Todd Zwillick here with Farai today. We're filling in today for John Hockenberry, who's away. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, Todd.
Good morning, Farai. This hour we'll remember Frank McCourt, the Angela Ashes author, passed away yesterday at 78. Also, current medicine allows women to give birth in their 50s and even into their 60s. The science may be sound, but some worry about the ethics. We'll also have a conversation about whether it's fair to their children. We're also talking about Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. She's in India right now. Wall Street Journal contributor Linda Blake is there, too. She's on the line with us. Linda, what's the mood like there in Delhi?
Well, Todd, Mother India seriously rolled out the red carpet. There's some serious Hillary hype circulating. Let's go to the Delhi streets.
Hillary is a celebrity, so it's interesting and people want to read about it, but I think we get a little carried away about our obsession with the U.S.
You know, I don't think she's going to be able to sort of contribute too much because the problem Pakistan and India is too embedded.
Pakistan and India is too embedded. Are people on the street, Linda, giving Hillary any hope of moving the U.S. And India along on climate change?
I would say that the question on most Indians' minds now about all matters is this going to be another display of diplomatic fluff, or will the countries at last collaborate on a substantive level and be able to work together and move forward without isolating the very things that make them independent nations?
All right, we'll talk about substance versus fluff, the Secretary of State in India, in just a minute. But first, everything you need to know this morning in the headlines. President Obama will mark 40 years since humans walked on the moon. The Apollo 11 crew visits the White House this afternoon. They're expected to lobby for a mission to Mars while they're there. Also, the White House schedule, the president's health care offensive we just mentioned will include a roundtable and a speech today.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports CIT's board approved a $3 billion emergency loan package. The money is from private sources. CIT faced bankruptcy after the government declined to bail it out. Now, CIT is one of the largest lenders to small and mid-sized businesses. Also, the New York Times reporting that the U.S. military wants to overhaul the controversial jail at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. This follows detainee abuse allegations there.
The Pentagon is calling a Taliban video of a captured American soldier illegal propaganda. It shows Private Bo Bergdahl. He went missing from his eastern Afghanistan base 3 weeks ago. The latest Harry Potter film is hot at the box office, sold nearly $160 million in 5 days. Asian markets closed up this morning. The Dow starts trading at 8743, the S&P at 940. We lost a true voice of American broadcasting this weekend, Walter Cronkite, and we want to know, is there anyone to replace him? Is there a new Walter Cronkite? Who's yours? Who's your torch of trust in the media? Is there one? 8778-MY-TAKE. MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here with Farai Chidea. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton meets with top Indian officials today in Delhi, including Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. It's part of her week-long trip to Asia, and it's also part of U.S. efforts to create a wider partnership between two countries that still struggle to overcome distrust rooted in those Cold War rivalries. Well, on the agenda is India's relationship with Pakistan, how to confront extremism, a possible nuclear arms deal in the works, and especially global warming, how to convince India that Western moves to curb greenhouse gases are not just a gambit to stifle rising economies like India's. Well, we're joined by Wall Street Journal contributor Linda Blake, who's been talking with people on the ground in Delhi. Linda, we talked a moment ago about substance versus fluff and everyday Indians' expectations for a visit from the Secretary of State on things like nuclear arms and things like greenhouse gas emissions and rising economies. What's the metric here? How do we tell the difference at the end of this visit between fluff versus substance?
I suppose beyond the handshakes, how many deals are actually implemented after the fact? And then looking forward, when she actually goes to Pakistan, or a U.S. representative does, is that same force, that same sort of statement that has been dispelled upon India being offered as well on Pakistani soil? For example, Hillary coming to India and explaining that we need to be hard on 2611, on those who have contributed terrorist atrocities against India. Justice must prevail. Is she also offering the same point of view in Pakistan, and thereby encouraging the government and entities there to be harsh on implicating those individuals directly involved who are associated with the LTE?
Do people appreciate, the people that you talk to on the street, do they appreciate the line that an American official like Hillary Clinton walks when she comes to India, has to condemn the hotel attacks in Mumbai, and has to turn around the very next day and praise Pakistan for its fight against extremism? They don't like to hear Pakistan praised in many parts of India, but do they appreciate the line an American Secretary of State has to walk?
I would have to say there is some appreciation, but there's an equal amount of skepticism, in that Indian interests are first and foremost, and many say she's really just doing the Hillary hokey pokey, left foot in India, right foot in Pakistan, and that they feel really left out of the equation, in essence. And your experts can talk a bit more about this with regards to AFPAC, with regards to India really being the center, the epicenter of all sort of terrorist activity in South Asia. It's embroiled at this point, and India wanting to, in effect, have a direct partnership and relationship with Hillary, in essence, be on the same team, and that there really isn't as much of an opportunity for that because, in your words, of the sort of line that she's treading, the back and forth between India and regions like Pakistan.
Well, I prefer your imagery of the Hillary hokey pokey, one foot in Pakistan, one foot in India. But is that a term that you came up with because you're creative, or are people actually saying that to you?
It's a term that I probably threw out because most people kept saying throughout the day, left foot in India, right foot
right,
in Pakistan.
Sure.
And I just pictured her turning herself around at that point.
Well, she's trying not to get turned around. Let's bring in Professor Brahma Chalani, Professor of Strategic Studies at the Center for Policy Research in Delhi, and also Richard Wolf of The Daily Beast. He's a columnist. He's joining us. He's a political analyst for MSNBC, and he's a senior strategist at Public Strategies. Professor Chalani, the idea of the Hillary hokey pokey that we're talking about, but it's a serious point. One foot in Pakistan, one foot in India. Do Indian people who the Secretary of State is trying to impress, do they appreciate the line that this official is forced to walk, given our interests in the region and the very tenuous state of our involvement with Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Hillary herself has a good image in India of being India-friendly, but under President Obama, U.S. policy on India has shifted. Under Bush, India was being looked at from the larger Asian geopolitical prism. But in the last 6 months, U.S. policy is looking at India increasingly from the AFPAC prism. Mm. And that has raised concern in India that India is being re-hyphenated with Pakistan. And that was the reason why Hillary Clinton did not stop in Pakistan on this trip. All previous visitors in the past 6 months who have been to India from Washington have stopped in Pakistan.
Right,
so
you make them equal. You travel, you make them equal, you show the world, and you show Indians and Pakistanis that it's a balanced trip, but she's not doing that this time.
Yeah, she's not doing that intentionally, because she's trying to allay India's concerns. So in that sense, it was important for her to come to India. But she came to India 6 months after becoming Secretary of State, and there were questions being asked whether Obama is going to take India seriously.
Richard Wolf, I want to turn to you, the Daily Beast and MSNBC analyst. I want to ask you a question about carbon emissions and climate change, because the Secretary of State was with the Indian Environment Minister yesterday, and he made a very explicit statement, more explicit than you normally hear in diplomatic circles. I'm paraphrasing. Sorry, the answer is no, we're not going to curb carbon emissions because we're a rising economy and we don't want to be stifled. Did that strike you as much as it struck me?
Oh, yeah, this is the most difficult thing. Frankly, even more difficult than the terrorist piece of this, because although India and Pakistan have their disputes, people know how to deal with this. The climate change has been stalled for such a long time, and the clock is ticking. They need a resolution, or at least the framework of a resolution, before they hit Copenhagen in December. The efforts to sort of come up with a successor to Kyoto, which never really went anywhere either. And India effectively scuppered the whole conversation at the G8, with China off scene as well. And it comes down to a sort of blame game. It's not just about sort of stifling growth. It's more subtle than that, which is India saying, well, you in the West and especially the United States were responsible for much of this global warming, so you have to do more. And while that balance of power or the blame game is still being played out there, it's a pretty tough haul for Secretary of State Clinton to come up with something close to a framework before December.
Professor Chalaney, you have written both about climate change and played quite a role in shaping India's nuclear policy. I want to ask about the weapons issue. What is it exactly, from your perspective as an individual with this experience, that you think the U.S. should be doing and Secretary Clinton should be doing specifically?
Right now, they are the two sides are actually about to sign an end-use monitoring agreement that would open commercial opportunities for U.S. arms companies in India. So that's an important step forward. But apart from that, the two countries are also engaged now in increased military-to-military cooperation. So the military relationship is going well, but they do have serious differences now on issues like China and the AFPAC strategy of President Obama, because the U.S. Policy on AFPAC basically is focused on the terrorist sanctuaries in Pakistan's western region, the area bordering Afghanistan, while the threat to India comes from the terrorist sanctuaries and the training camps on Pakistan's eastern border with India. And U.S. policy isn't really focused on those issues. And the Indians are trying to persuade Washington to have a more holistic approach to the terrorism problem in Pakistan.
Well, Linda Blake, Wall Street Journal contributor, I want to bring that question to you. Has the secretary tried to convince Indians that there's a nexus in interest there? We're obviously trying to fight extremists in Pakistan, and have we successfully convinced Indians yet that our fight against extremists in Pakistan is the same as their fight?
I think the overall insight is India is sort of in a strategic point, whether you look at Indonesia and that prospectively being in an Al-Qaeda training ground, or you look at what's going on in Pakistan with the LTE. And I read on a Facebook wall, in fact, an Indian friend of mine, he basically wrote, look, India, we're just waiting for our next terrorist attack. And the fact is, India is the perfect place strategically to have one terrorist group or the other act out a dress rehearsal for future attacks on the Western world. So you're sort of looking at this place as the training ground, as the boot camp. And in that regard, on many Indians' minds, they're thinking, okay, we need to collaborate because we both have common enemies. I just want to give you one other story. I was with a street vendor, and usually I'm asked in this country, which country, madam, which country are you from? And when I said America today, what he basically said is, you know, we're on the same team now. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, you know, we've both been struck. Yeah, we've both been struck by enemies on our home territory, on our home ground. So we need to work together.
Richard Wolff, Daily Beast, can we bring Indians onto our team, being on the same team now, without alienating Pakistan at this critical time?
Well, it's tough because of regional rivalry, and it's obviously a new situation given the thaw in India's approach to the West generally. But I do think that there is an awful lot of common ground if the two sides, India and Pakistan, can set aside their regional rivalry and see the common interest they have. And most particularly, you know...
But Richard, does making arms deals with India at the kickoff of this week help that situation if it's going to alienate the Pakistanis?
They're both getting arms deals. That's the truth.
Thank you.
If you get them both to sit down as they did in Egypt last week, the question is, are they talking to each other or at each other's home constituencies? And that's the key thing.
All right, Richard Wolff of The Daily Beast. He's also a political analyst for MSNBC and senior strategist at Public Strategies. We were also joined by Professor Brahma Chalaney. He's a professor of strategic studies at the Center for Policy Research in Delhi. And, of course, Linda Blake, Wall Street Journal contributor who's in Delhi. She's stationed there, played us some great sound from the streets of Delhi and giving us a sense of how Indians are approaching Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's visit to India. She's trying to advance U.S. interests on greenhouse gases and nuclear arms. Thank you all for joining us. You put your left foot out, you put your left foot in,
and you shake it all about. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, Todd Zwillick here with Farai today, and we're talking about two great voices that have been lost over the weekend. Walter Cronkite, of course, broadcaster and legend of the news business. We'll be talking about Mr. Cronkite in just a moment. But first, Frank McCourt died yesterday, Irish author. He died of cancer in New York City. He was 78, and he died of melanoma. Well, joining us to talk more about McCourt's, influence is New York Times reporter Motoko Rich, who covers the publishing world. He's going to talk to us about Angelus Ashes and other books that McCourt wrote. Motoko, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, McCourt's influence to the literary world. People are talking about the misery he could project and the humor that he could project at the same time. Do you see that as his legacy on the writing world?
It's certainly one of them. One of the remarkable things about the book Angela's Ashes, which many critics remarked upon and readers sort of seized upon, was that he was describing this incredibly horrible, miserable childhood without bitterness, and as you said, with great humor. And I think that's sort of what took it from a nicely, well-received in the critical world book to something that went totally planetary in terms of sales. It sold 4 million copies in hardcover, which you can't do without people sort of passing this book on and saying, you must read this, you must read this. I loved it.
And even in the days before Facebook and a lot of the networking that sells a lot of books right now, it's quite amazing. Let's listen to McCourt. You're talking about humor. Let's listen to him comment on his own writing in that regard.
I think there was something about the way we live that forced us to see the humor. And something, because if you gave into eternal gloom all the time, you were dead.
Well, what made Frank McCourt able to project that in a way that other writers, maybe contemporaneous to him, weren't quite able to do?
Well, I don't know if there weren't others who were able to do it at the time, but and I think he talked about this himself, that he had tried to write this memoir 20 years before, and he was trying to sort of emulate James Joyce and be very high-minded about it. And then when he came back to it, he sort of found a voice, I think he mentioned sort of on the playground, that it was really a childlike voice. So when you're reading Angela's Ashes, there's something amazing about it because it's so beautifully written and obviously written by an adult, and yet somehow you feel you're in the head of a child.
What about his influence on the business of books? Motoko, it's Farai. How you doing?
Hi,
Farai. First of all, what seems to be a rise of the memoir. Secondly, what seems to be a fall of the publishing industry, you know?
Right.
How does he fit into either of those, an anomaly, a trend?
I certainly think that he was an anomaly at the time. I mean, it was incredible at the time. There had been other memoirs, for example, Mary Carr's Liar's Club, which was very popular. But for him to have sold the number of copies and lasted as long as he did on the bestseller list, while also winning a Pulitzer Prize, by the way, I mean, that doesn't happen very often, that someone who is given such literary acclaim also lasts that long on the bestseller list. And I think at the time it was seen as an anomaly. And again, he didn't start the memoir trend, but he certainly made it into a global phenomenon. And then, of course, as these in publishing, it always happens, regardless of what the genre is, if something is that successful, then everybody rushes in and tries to imitate it. And that has lasted to this day, the sort of memoir trend.
And is there another case, though, of somebody being a first-time author, a first-time chronicler, and coming out of the gate selling 4 million in hardback?
I don't know about 4 million in hardback, but it does occasionally happen. I mean, every once in a while, the publishers will get really excited. It tends to happen more, I think, on the novel side, where they'll get really, really excited about a book, and they'll pay quite a lot of money for it, and it will do very, very well. A few years ago, there was The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. It was her first novel. Little Brown paid a couple $1 million for it, and it really sold a lot of copies.
So just real quick, Motoko, do you think that Frank McCourt's influence on the book world and on the memoir world, more specifically, was it on his writing of the memoir that he helped, well, at least helped launch this fantastically selling genre, or was it more his writing style and that people tried to emulate the way he wrote
You know, I don't know as much as whether people were trying to emulate the way he wrote, mm-hmm. because I think part of what memoir is to develop your own voice, and you don't want to be known as, you know, the Frank McCourt imitator. So I think it was more the idea for publishers and for readers as well that personal stories that were, people's personal true stories, and that certainly reading about something so miserable, if transformed and in this inspirational voice and humor, could also be in some ways enjoyable, as opposed to just sort of grim and reading about the hard knocks.
All right. Frank McCourt dead at age 78 in New York City, author of the best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning Angela's Ashes. Matoka Rich covers the publishing world for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us to talk to us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to talk a little bit more about television news icon Walter Cronkite. He retired a quarter of a century ago, but he didn't stop working. He became critical of the state of journalism today, as he showed in a 1996 interview at the Newseum.
I regret that in our attempt to establish some standards, we didn't make them stick. We couldn't find a way to pass them on to another generation, really.
Now joining us is New York Times media reporter Brian Stelter to talk about Cronkite's role as a critic and champion of the media. Brian, in that clip we just played, he is very clear that news standards, in his opinion, slipped. What was he talking about towards the latter years of his life?
It was interesting to watch Cronkite's views of journalism evolve over the 28 years after he left the CBS Evening News. And in particular, you could even see him, in mostly in a gracious way, even comment on his successors at CBS. He sat on the board at CBS for about 10 years after retirement. But he really found disappointment in the budget cuts that were made at CBS, and he felt that the journalism wasn't being practiced the way it should have been at CBS and elsewhere, and eventually departed for that network and didn't do much for that network over time.
There's a quote where he says, 24 hours after I told CBS News that I was stepping down at my 65th birthday, I was already regretting it. Was there any sense of a light at the end? I don't want to say the end of the tunnel, but I'm sort of headed that direction. Was there anything he saw that was going well in the business?
He spoke, all through the decades about the continued importance of the evening news. I think some people would look at 2009 and say it's surprising that we still have evening newscasts. Clearly, they are not as popular as they were in Cronkite's time, but they're still on the air, and they still get 24 or 25 million viewers a night. And so I think he would look at the evening newscast and be thankful that the networks have at least kept some sort of evening newscast on the air in that way. However, he has talked about how those anchors in future generations, the ones after him, were more newsreaders and less reporters, and he really valued that role of being in Vietnam, for example, or doing that 14-minute long report about Watergate on the evening newscast.
Well, we have to stop there, Brian. There's so much to talk about. Again, Brian Stelter, media reporter for the New York Times.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here with Farai Chidea. We're both here for John Hockenberry. And we've been talking this morning about Walter Cronkite, the career and life of Walter Cronkite, who died at 92 in New York just on Friday. Check out thetakeaway.org. John Hockenberry has a blog posting about Cronkite's influence on his journalistic career, on Hockenberry's journalistic career, and even some personal interactions they had. It's a very, very interesting read. Check it out on thetakeaway.org. Meantime, it's now time for our headlines, and that's Femi Okeh, who's here.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Delhi today, where she's praising India's neighbor Pakistan for taking on extremists. Secretary Clinton says it's part of her mission to enlist all countries, including India, to help in the fight against terrorism. Moving to southern Afghanistan, a NATO fighter jet crashed earlier today while taking off from an airbase in Kandahar. The two men on board ejected from the plane. Here in the United States, the former NFL star Michael Vick is released after 2 months of house arrest. He also spent 18 months in federal prison after being convicted of running a dogfighting ring. A California wildfire has caused campgrounds in the Inyo National Forest to be evacuated. The blaze has grown to actually take in around about 2,000 acres. Now, while the world is celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon mission, one small group of dissenters continue to claim that the entire mission was a hoax. Filmmaker Bart Sobrell is one of the disbelievers. Now, here is a clip from moonmovie.com. It's the famous moment where Sobrell is confronting astronaut Buzz Aldrin with his moonwalk hoax theory.
You're the one who said you walked on the moon when you didn't. Calling the kettle black, if I ever thought of it. Saying
will
I misrepresented
myself.
Will
you get away from me?
You're a coward and a liar and a thief.
Was Are that, you shocked?
Was that what I thought it was?
That Ouch. Was the sound of Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, throwing a right hook. Now, he will be on his best behavior today.
better be.
Wow. When he joins his crew members from the Apollo 11 mission at the White House, and the crew are expected to lobby the president for a mission to Mars.
Yeah,
what happens if the president says no?
I don't think the president's going to accuse them. I don't think he's going to accuse them of having not gone to the moon. I don't think it's going to reach that point. Jeez, don't cross Buzz Aldrin. He'll cross you with a right hook.
He's got a mean right hook.
Man, oh, man. All right, well, thanks, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Stay out of Buzz Aldrin's way. Well, President Obama is going to stay out of Buzz Aldrin's way, but he wants to pass his health care plan before Congress goes on recess in August. But Friday's news from the Congressional Budget Office may have put a few speed bumps in his way there. The CBO reported that they saw no way that health care spending would decrease over the next decade. And that's the point the president's been trying to make. He wants to lower the cost of health care, the trajectory of the rise of those health care costs. And he says if he doesn't get a bill that's going to do that, he's going to veto the bill. And the CBO said the bill in Congress right now in the House is not going to do it. Well, controlling such costs is one of his major goals, and so he's giving insurance to, and so is giving insurance, by the way, to more than 45 million Americans, 48 million Americans who don't have coverage. The president and others spent the rest of the weekend on the Sunday talk shows defending the plan.
I want to be very clear. I will not sign on to any health plan that adds to our deficits over the next decade. And by helping improve quality and efficiency, the reforms we make will help bring our deficits under control in the long term.
Now, the president says his policies will save on costs, but there's a lot of people in Congress who are not convinced. Joining us is Trudy Lieberman, director of the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School in Journalism. Trudy, I think most of us knew that the president's plan was going to cost a lot of money. Now the talkers in Washington are saying that the plan is teetering. I don't know if I buy that. We always expected this to be a tough fight, no matter whether it was Republicans or Democrats, right?
Well, I think we did expect it to be a tough fight, but there's been a lot of hype surrounding the plan, a lot of public relations, a lot of spin, both from the administration and other cheerleaders for the plan, from some of the grassroots advocacy groups that want this plan. But the cost issue has always been there. And the bottom line is that there really is not the cost savings that the administration hopes for in the plan. You're not going to get it out of health IT, and you're not going to get it out of preventive care, which is actually going to cost money.
Well, okay, the cost is not going to come down, according to CBO, but the president keeps saying, and his allies in Congress keep saying, that all these CBO numbers that come out don't account for the fact that they can save a lot on preventive care. They can save a lot on keeping people healthier. It's just the CBO doesn't know how to account for it. And so then I cover Congress. This is going to be smoke and mirrors now.
Yeah, it is smoke and mirrors. I did a piece for CJR.org where I am a contributor and write a blog on health care reform. And we interviewed Louise Russell, and I believe she's also been on the Takeaway. She is the premier academic, has studied preventive care. And her conclusion, and all the academic studies have shown that preventive care, while it might be good in some cases, does not save money. It costs money. And that is one thing that the members of Congress simply do not want to understand.
All right. So what does the president have in front of him this week as he tries to balance his conservative Democrats in the House who say we're not going to support deficit increases and we can't support all this spending? And then in the Senate, where he's under pressure to do what he said in the campaign he wouldn't do, which is tax health benefits. But the bottom line is he needs the money. Where does he go from here?
Well, the real issue is that the money really isn't there based on what they're talking about now. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has said that the only big pool of money available is taxing employer-provided benefits. And we know that the unions do not want that, as well as some members of Congress.
Well, he's an advocate for gutting the employer-sponsored health insurance. We get our health insurance through our employers. He's an advocate for gutting that altogether. Ron Wyden.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Wyden does want to do that. But the point that Ron Wyden made was that that's the only place right now that you can get a big pool of money short of raising the payroll tax or a VAT tax or some other great big source of revenue.
Well, there's definitely a question about where the money is going to come from, you know, not just from, you know, for this specific issue, but also in general. There's a little bit on NBC's Meet the Press from Mitch McConnell talking about the difficulty of folding this into the overall picture.
We're going to have a deficit this year, $1.8 trillion, that's bigger than the deficit of the last 5 years combined. They passed a budget that puts us on a path to double the national debt in 5 years, triple it in 10, and here comes health care.
Okay, this is the senator from Kentucky, a state where, like everywhere else, people need health care, but he's raising the issue that it's just so difficult to do at this time. Is this the best of times, one where, as we examine all the budget priorities, this is a good one, or the worst of times to do this?
Well, I think that there is some urgency to get more people under the insurance umbrella. I mean, people are really hurting and they don't have insurance. And those chickens are now coming home to roost in Massachusetts.
That's classic. They want that's politics. Well, people want reform. They just don't want to pay for it in a lot of cases. That's what I'm hearing on the Hill and around the governors. Well, thanks, Trudy Lieberman, Director of Health and Medicine Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Thanks for talking us through the healthcare debate.
And look, coming up in 10 minutes, how old is too old to be a parent? We'll talk about that with New York Times blogger Lisa Belkin and another journalist who had a child, her third, or actually her fourth, at the age of 53. That's in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. The disputed erection in Iran happened way back on June 12th, but it's back in the headlines today. A group of reformist clerics, including a former president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, have called for a national referendum on the election process following last month's disputed vote. The group said millions of Iranians had lost confidence in the election process, which saw Mahmoud Ahmadinejad reelected. Of course, this is just a couple of days after Iran's supreme leader warned elites not to rile up the country. Another warning coming from the supreme leader of Iran. Well, BBC's Iran correspondent John Lyne is currently in London, and he joins us now. John, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, what is the former president, Mohammad Khatami, actually calling for here? The news reports say he wants a referendum, but what kind of referendum? Is he talking about a referendum on the elections themselves or a referendum on the government?
Well, he wants a referendum. He doesn't specify, really, but basically he wants a referendum on the disputed election result. And he says it should be conducted by an independent body. He's chosen his independent body as the Expediency Council, which just happens to be chaired by one of his allies, former President Rafsanjani. So I'm not sure everybody in Iran would agree that it is independent. And frankly, I don't think there's any prospect whatsoever that this idea will be taken up. It's just a way for the opposition to press their campaign on that the election is not accepted by the Iranian people.
So we have some coordination, it seems, between Ali Akbar Rafsanjani, another former president, as you said, who spoke out the other day and said the country was in crisis over this disputed elections. Now we have Khatami calling for a referendum. Does this coordination of message, you say it won't, the idea won't be taken up, but what are the prospects for actual leverage over the government now?
Well, if you look, really, the government, the country, really, is now deeply split. You now have two former presidents. Here's former President Khatami, former President Rafsanjani, who spoke on Friday. Both of them, in varying degrees, have come out against the election result. You have the only former prime minister the country has. You have one or at least maybe two speakers of parliament, current or former, who are expressing their doubts. So the country is deeply, deeply divided, and now there are more divisions within the government itself over an appointment made by President Ahmadinejad. So I think the government fundamentally, the system even you might say, is leaking support by the day.
So you think we may be seeing sort of an attrition, a long, I don't want to read too much into it, a long slow march to some kind of influence over the government. So far since the election, they've been fairly obstinate and almost deaf to a lot of the protests that have been going on.
Well, don't listen to me. Listen to what the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has said today. Very telling comments. He said, the elite are undergoing an important test. If they fail, they won't just suffer a setback. They will meet their downfall. So now we have even the supreme leader acknowledging that the very system, or at least the people who run it, are under severe threat by what is going on, by these divisions. Remember, it's not just people out on the street, and there have been quite a few of them. It's a division at the very heart of the Islamic Republic. Former President Rafsanjani, who criticized what had been going on, he's the person who almost effectively appointed the supreme leader. He stood up in 1989 and said, Ayatollah Khomeini has told me that Ayatollah Khamenei would be a good successor. So you see these divisions are now going right to the very heart of the system, right to the very top of the leadership.
Very quickly, John Lyne, BBC, what is the state of the street protests? We don't hear a lot about them quickly.
There were a lot of people came out on Friday. It's difficult to tell how many. The opposition claimed up to a million or more, but certainly the protests have not gone away.
They're trying to support Mir Hussein Mousavi, the candidate who in the elections disputed against Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. BBC's Iran correspondent John Lyne joining us from London to talk about the latest challenges to the government in Iran.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I am Farai Chidea here with Todd Zwillick. We're sitting in for John Hockenberry. Okay, there's a woman who had a baby at 70, another one who had a baby at 67. How old is too old to be a mother, to be a parent in general? We'll find that out in 10 minutes right after headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is meeting with Indian leaders in New Delhi right now. She'll have a press conference in a couple of minutes. Hot topics include nuclear policy and trade, and she also wants a counter-terror partnership with India.
We enlist the help of everyone in countries like India, who have such a stake in the end of terrorism and extremism because of the personal costs that have been paid by generations of Indians.
After the India visit, Secretary Clinton will go to Thailand. Clinton also visited Mumbai, the city where terrorists killed more than 160 in November. The only surviving gunman is now pleading guilty to the attacks. He originally pleaded not guilty and was on trial. Healthcare is a hot topic on President Obama's agenda today. He's attending a roundtable on the topic and will give a speech. And this comes as Congress debates several bills making major healthcare changes. Now, I've just been watching NASA TV on my laptop in the news hub. So I've been watching a live press conference by five of the Apollo missions, and they were all astronauts all sitting there. Of course, some of the astronauts from the Apollo 11 mission, it's celebrating its 40th anniversary. At the top of the press conference, here's Jim Lovell. He was the captain of Apollo 13.
This is really a national celebration. This is really a celebration for all those people that helped Neil and Buzz and Mike make that final 60 miles travel to the surface of the moon.
And the crew of Apollo 11, once they finish their Q&A public session, will be heading off to the White House to meet up with President Obama, where they're expected to push for a Mars mission. And finally, a man who turned a rough childhood into acclaimed literature has died. Author Frank McCourt is dead at 78. He died in New York, and he's best known for the popular memoir Angela's Ashes. And it was about his childhood growing up poor in Ireland. And the book, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize. That's a look at top stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Once you enter this family, there's no getting out.
There's been a lot of lying in this family.
And a lot of love.
More lies.
And I met this girl, so I invited her here. Is that okay?
No.
Maybe you can just accept who I am and love me anyway.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Family therapy? What the hell is this?
You said we were going out for frosty chocolate milkshakes.
Once you enter this family, there's no getting out.
We're talking about family, as we do every Monday morning, and we're going to explore a hot-button issue of when is too old to have children. The world's oldest woman who gave birth died last week, a Spanish woman who had twins when she was 67 years old, but cancer took her life just 3 years after those children were born. Lisa Belkin wrote about the issue in this past weekend's issue of the New York Times blog Motherlode, Adventures in Parenting. She joins us now from Bronxville, New York, and also with us, Karen Day, a 56-year-old mother of a 3-year-old. She also has three older children. She's an independent journalist, and Karen joins us from her home in Haley, Idaho. Morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Lisa, for those who haven't heard of Maria del Carmen, who was she and how did she end up being a mother at 66?
Well, from all reports, she was a woman who always wanted to have children. She never married. Her mother would not have approved of her having children unmarried. And so when her mother passed away, she was Maria was 67 years old and still wanted children. And the technology exists. Now, she had to lie because most clinics have a cutoff in their 50s. But she lied to a clinic in California and said she was 55 years old and she gave birth at 67 as a single mom.
Now, some people may use her death at 69 when her children are just toddlers to say that she was unequivocally too old. But do you have a date in your mind? When do you think is too old, if there is any point?
I remember when my son was a toddler and our neighbor across the street, who was prematurely gray but quite young and energetic and 40, was pregnant. And he looked at me and said, you know, Kathy's having a baby. Isn't she too old? It's subjective, and there is no longer a cutoff. I mean, it used to be that nature took care of that, and now we have technology that can override nature. And there's a feeling on the one hand of, well, we need to do something about this. I mean, we need to control this, and it's a tragedy when a mother dies and leaves children this young. It doesn't mean mothers don't die and leave young children at any age, but you're increasing the odds. If you have a child older, you are guaranteeing less time with them than if you have a child younger. On the other hand, I chafe at the idea of, well, let's regulate this.
Right.
Because where do you draw a legislative line? What I think a conversation can do is create a more agreed upon social line, and let's keep it in perspective. These women are outliers.
Well, let's go to an outlier, Karen Day. You made what some people would interpret as a similar decision to have a baby at the age of 53. A lot of people call, a last child who comes after some other children far behind the caboose. But if your youngest child is a caboose,
surprise, right?
Exactly.
Or a debacle.
Right, but this was not a surprise.
You know it in your Depends, yes.
So this wasn't a surprise, though. You tried hard to have this baby. Tell us a little bit of your story.
Well, you know, I already had 3 children, and none of them had turned into serial killers, even though I progressively have had 4 children in 4 decades. But my new husband had never been able to have children because of fertility issues, and the technology just came into existence within the 2 or 3 years when we had met each other kind of on the last lap of, you know, the last chance lap there. And so we looked into having a surrogate, which was when we really looked at it professionally. I'm a journalist. I did a lot of research. You know, and it's a lot when you're looking, you're looking to buy the mother of your child services. It was upwards of $60,000.
Wow.
And it was actually the fertility doctor that suggested, look, you're in perfect condition. You've already had 3 successful pregnancies. You're a fit 53-year-old. Why don't we look at you? And, of course, the other thing was I had not reached menopause. But that's not a predictive situation. I mean, I asked him if I was the, after laboring with my own belief systems about the fact that I was too old, and my husband was exactly my age, he said that he also had a 59-year-old woman who had given birth for her daughter who was incapable of carrying her own children. So,
let me just quickly...
my first question, though, is when we look at, should this be regulated, why isn't there, I was reading last night that there is a 90-year-old man who just fathered his 21st child, and why is the conversation immediately towards, a woman who, of course, might be increasing the odds of dying when her children get older? Of course, just the first child is enough to make you, consider using a butter knife on your wrist, because that's so shocking. By the fourth time, I knew exactly what to,
right,
expect.
Let me go back to Lisa for a second.
This man's too old.
Well, Karen, you did get to the issue of regulation, which I wanted to. But Lisa, what about what Karen's saying about old dads? There's some evidence now that sperm is not the same forever, and although men can use it longer than women can have fertility, that it's a double-edged sword.
It is, but we are different biologically, and we chafe at that. I don't like it either. I don't like the fact that men can do whatever they want for as long as they want, and society gives them a pass. And women, we have these kinds of conversations. But there is one reality, of course, which is when a 91-year-old man has a child, he is by definition having it with a woman who is still young enough to have a child. So you have parents, at least one of whom is younger. When an older woman has a child, she is not, by definition, having it with a partner who is still young and likely to be around. So they just are, we can yell and scream and not like it, but there is a biological difference.
That's from Lisa Belkin, writer for Motherlode, Adventures in Parenting for the New York Times. And we also heard from Karen Day, a 53-year-old mother of a 3-year-old and a journalist as well. Thanks so much.
Thanks for Iowa. We lost a voice who informed America for decades, newscaster Walter Cronkite. He was a major news figure. But we want to know from you, who's taking his torch? Who's your Walter Cronkite these days? Who do you trust? Or do you trust no one in the media?
Keith Jorgensen from Stoughton, Mass. Bill O'Reilly is my news hero. I think he's fair and balanced, as he says he is. Sometimes controversial, but he's a lot of fun, and I believe him.
Bill O'Reilly. Liz emails us. Rachel Maddow, the woman is so on the money. She's smart, cute, funny, and unafraid of people in the hot seat. Nate emails us. Whether or not there is someone to replace Walter Cronkite, their voice won't be heard. There's too much of a chaotic multitude in the media. Tell us your take on this at our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James O. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.